Hello and welcome back to our four-part series on understanding Islam with Father Damien Howard. Damien, part three now, and we are going to talk about Islamic law.
Fantastic. Very important, right to the heart of things.
Sharia law. Now, sometimes people are a little bit worried about Sharia law, but that's perhaps because they're worried about it in a UK context. But tell us a little bit about Sharia law. Give us a brief introduction to Sharia.
Just think of this for a moment. God has a particular idea of what human life and human society should look like, and that's a society and a life that will be happy and fulfilled, and God wants us to live that kind of life, and he wants to lead us to the watering hole in the desert, and that's what the word Sharia means. It's the path to the watering hole. It's the place where we get sustenance and where we get the kind of support that we need to live good, balanced human lives. So that's the first thing. Second thing, Sharia is more a method for getting that law than any particular content. So God has given an indication in the sources of Islam about what that law should look like. So you get passages in the Quran which tell you, for instance, how to divide up your goods when you die for inheritance purposes, who you can marry, how often you can marry, those sorts of things. Then in the Hadith, do you remember I said in part one that the Hadith help us to interpret the Quran, to understand what it means? So you put all of that together and you start to have a sense of what God would say were you to ask a particular question to him. So, for example, I happen to be quite partial to gin and tonic. Am I allowed to drink gin and tonic? Is this part of God's vision of a good human life? Well, funnily enough, in the Quran, at one stage, God does say something vaguely positive about alcohol.
Surely
about
not.
Wine. It does, absolutely, yes. God's first utterance about the subject of drink is kind of, you know, there are good things and bad things about this. But then God legislates that being inebriated during your prayer is not a good thing, it's not acceptable. So you should be sober when you make your prayers. But then if you think about how often Muslims pray, which is five times a day, quite difficult getting in that crafty gin and tonic so that it's never going to affect any of your prayers. And so by the third time that God speaks about alcohol, he's banned it. All right? So there's that kind of movement in the Quran towards a final prohibition. And God makes it what we call in Arabic haram, forbidden. Okay? And I think most people know that about Islamic belief. So that's an example of Islamic law. That's an example of Sharia. And so you can see why, I mean, virtually all Muslims would agree that alcohol is haram, is forbidden. So that you can see there's a fairly standard idea there about Sharia law. But things get much more complicated when you get into more complex matters, finance or family law.
What about communities, or rather, and I'm going to use the wrong terminology, but if you had an elder or somebody who is in charge of like a sort of Sharia court,
right?
Is it the community that decides, or a group of nominated people that decide how to carry out Sharia law? Tell us a bit about carrying out the law.
A very good question indeed. In a society like Britain, nobody carries out Sharia law in the sense that we don't have official Muslim judges with the state behind them, giving them the power to make decisions. So Sharia is a private matter. Muslims agree to be bound by the judgments of a Sharia court, for example, a husband and wife, for example, if they were trying to come to a conclusion about their marriage, might both agree to go to a Sharia court. The person in charge would be a scholar who's trained for many years, who's mastered the Quran and Arabic and Hadith and understands the tradition of his particular law school and is able, therefore, to give fairly definitive answers to particular questions that people have. So, for example, I'm a Muslim. I want to work in a newsagent where they sell alcohol. Am I allowed to? I'm not going to drink the alcohol myself, but am I allowed to
facilitate others
to drink it? So your Muslim scholar would look at that question, look at the precedents, make a balanced judgment, and issue what we call a fatwa. And a fatwa is not a death sentence, it's simply a legal verdict. And the content of that legal verdict will either be, that's absolutely fine, that's halal, which means permitted, go ahead, or, on the contrary, it might be haram, or it might be some intermediary status, like, you know, you can do it, but I wouldn't do it if I were you, it's not advisable, or you oughtn't to do it, but, you know, no one's going to punish you if you do.
I'm sure there are very few people in the UK that actually think would imagine there's any such thing as a positive fatwa. But as you say, probably because they don't understand what it is.
Right. You know, a fatwa is, as I say, it's just a legal verdict, a legal decision. And it could be made in all sorts of situations.
Most people remember Salman Rushdie and the Satanic Verses.
That's right. Well, it's just a shame that the people were just becoming aware of Islam and its vocabulary at a time when this fatwa in question, that of the Ayatollah Khomeini, was a death threat.
I mean, this is a slight recap, but where exactly does the law come from? How was it formed?
Right. Well, in a sense, it goes all the way back to Muhammad. I mean, Muhammad is, by the time he's living in the city of Medina, he's, if you like, not quite the right word, but he's a sort of head of state figure. He's legislating. He's telling the people who live there how they're going to live their lives, and they're very happy to submit to that on the whole. So you've already got, if you like, the framework for a legal religion, a religion of law, rather similar to Judaism in a way, which is also very much a religion of law, in a way that Christianity doesn't really feel like that. You know, we don't expect necessarily to go to a priest and he'll tell us where we can work or how many hours we should work or those sorts of things. From there you get the expectation, I think, that God has a preference or God has a will for every single domain of human life. You know, God really does have a vision of what is good. So Muslims can go into extraordinary detail, you know, the length of their clothes, body hair, all sorts of things which we wouldn't necessarily regard as religious, can become important for some Muslims, and particularly imitating the Prophet. Muhammad, I tried to say this in the first interview we did, Muhammad is a source of emulation. You can copy the Prophet because everything he's doing is guided by God. Muhammad won't make a mistake. Mm-hmm. So that if the Prophet takes his right shoe off before his left shoe, then that's an indication of the right way to go about it.
Tell me a little bit about evolution of the law or how the law progresses. Does the law progress? Are interpretations ever changing of Sharia law?
Yeah, that's very much how Islamic law works. It's built up over many centuries within the institution of a particular law school. So actually, your local law scholar possibly won't be, well, he certainly won't be making his own legal decisions based on his reading of the Quran or the Hadith. He goes back to the body of case law that's built up over the centuries in his particular law school. And there are four big Sunni law schools. The second thing to say, though, would be this, and this is something that many Muslims themselves have said. About the 12th century, Islamic law does suddenly become very conservative. People talk about what they call the closure of the gate of ijtihad, which means, you know, people stop thinking for themselves and they simply copy all the decisions made previously by great scholars of the past. Why? Well, because Islam has this idea that the closer you are to the Prophet, then the closer you are to understanding the truth. The further we get away from the Prophet, the more difficult it is to know what God wants for us to do. There's a kind of downward slope. You know, this is very much the mentality of the Golden Age. Look back to the time of the Prophet. Everything was going well then. Things have got a bit worse since then. That tends to be how Muslims have viewed the past. And the result of that is, well, the great scholars were all in the first few hundred years of Islam, and now we're not really as good as them. So we're not entitled. We don't have the gifts necessary or the brains and the judgment to make the kinds of decisions that they made. And therefore, there is no actual evolution. And that's been a big, big problem for Muslims in the last couple of hundred years because, of course, faced with the problems of the modern world, of European civilization, which has made itself really powerfully felt all over the world, you do need to make new laws and decisions. And so that rather conservative style of Islamic law has become a bit of a problem. That's why many Muslims have said, well, enough of the tradition. We need to get back to the sources and we need to start thinking for ourselves.
Fascinating stuff, Father Damien. So that is, in a reasonable nutshell, Islamic law. Okay, when we return for part four, we are going to, I wouldn't really say conclude, but we are going to examine the relationship between Islam and Christianity and all things concerned with it.